All right, so I hope I remembered roughly where we stopped yesterday. So the picture that we were working through was this, albeit a little bit contrived system, but will turn out to have a lot of relevance for gravitational waves in LIGO, where we imagined in some nice Cartesian coordinate system, we have two masses separated by distance r, spinning with frequency, with angular frequency omega, in the xy plane, despite my inability to draw. And we'll put an observer. Not everything really would have mattered. One of them, oh, good question. Thanks. We'll put the observer directly above, at some distance, r, which is important for at least one of the formulas I show at some point, but not incredibly important. So you can imagine the distance is extremely, the observer is extremely far away at some distance r, which we can take as c. Yeah, of course.
Since you have a big R and little r, when you say r,
big, big R versus little r, yes, I will. So for the most part, most of the r's we're going to see are going to be the big R, because we're going to talk about properties of the source itself. But the observer is a distance r, and that's certainly going to come up in the gravitational wave amplitude. So with this contrived system, what we kind of imagine is that these things are fixed, like on rods or something that are light, and moving at some constant angular velocity. Last time we got to the notion that gravitational waves actually do emit energy. So we could imagine this as a free system where they're just orbiting a center of mass gravitationally. But in that case, gravitational wave emission will actually take energy away from the system, and we will not any longer have these masses moving at some fixed r and some fixed omega. So that's kind of where we're headed today. And I think the last expression that we had talked about was the luminosity, for this particular binary, and I wanted people to take a stab at actually coming up with this formula, but we can honestly not necessarily go over that derivation today. People can have another day if they've not tried it. But the result was 128 over 5. This applies to this system, m squared capital R to the fourth, omega to the sixth. So in this system, the m, r, and omega are all independent parameters, right? But again, it's a contrived system because we're fixing these things to look like this. In actual fact, if we instead have a binary, and even if we just model the motion with Newtonian gravity, which I know we're talking about things in general relativity, but basically, certainly Kepler's law, when these things are far away and not moving very fast, basically normal Newtonian dynamics is perfectly reasonable over at least a period or more. For that, we have to figure out how this luminosity is affecting the actual change in either the orbital frequency or orbital period. Either way would be perfectly fine and equivalent. And if I take this formula and instead of letting these things be independent, build in Kepler's law, then I get some, I think I showed this last time, 128 over 5, there's a 4 to the 1/3, pi m over p to the 10/3. So did we get that far? And then we basically stopped, right? Okay, great.
You might have already said this, but is the spectrum all coming out at frequency omega, or are you getting kind of a distribution?
So in the contrived example, it would be entirely at omega. But it is a contrived example, because what you're basically doing, I mean, physically, you'd have to be putting energy into the system to keep it going.
Yeah.
And so you're sort of forcing the gravitational wave emission to be monochromatic. If you allow it instead to evolve as free bodies, and granted, we're not doing this in some full GR, but just with Newtonian evolution of the orbit, but taking into account energy loss from gravitational waves, so you're just adding that in as sort of a balancing term, then what you find is that the luminosity is changing as a function of period, but the missing piece here is that since it's losing energy, the orbital parameters of the binary have to also be changing, because the only energy in the system is the kinetic and potential energies that come from Newtonian gravity. So the system is actually evolving and the orbit's shrinking, and so it's not monochromatic if you allow it to be free.
It is, but it's drifting.
It's drifting, yeah. And to the extent that which it's monochromatic, when it's really not relativistic and far, far away, the sort of monochromatic over many cycles approximation is really excellent. This is a technical thing that I'm not going to get into, but like, it's one of the reasons why we can use analytic approximations to the Fourier transforms for these things, called the stationary phase approximation, precisely because the phase is not really evolving that quickly. And it's a super powerful thing in data analysis, but yeah.
If I was making up a new theory of a scalar that I wonder if it's getting radiated, it sounds like there's a kinematic thing that says the mass gets above the frequency of the orbit and it doesn't get radiated just on energetic grounds. Because the quanta, there's no quanta to go into because it all has to be monochromatic. Is that right? Supposing, you know what I mean? Supposing I had a scalar field and supposing there'll be some different formula for the amplitude to be radiated, but if it's coming out at the frequency, I had to have the frequency available to me. So if the spectrum is bounded below by the mass and the mass is bigger than omega, there's no states.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, so I don't have a good sense of that. This the fact that it basically stays stable in gravitational waves is really extremely accurate when the system is far away. Like all normal systems, this is true. I mean, the Earth Sun system. I didn't repeat this calculation. I'm remembering from like grad school, so this might be wrong. Is like 200 watts of emission or something. The Earth is radiating 200 watts as it orbits around the Sun. If you were to do this kind of, so I mean, it's actually kind of a, in some sense, a big number. 200 watts is like, you know, light bulbs. I mean, there's real energy there. On the other hand, when you consider 200 watts with respect to the binding energy of the Earth-Sun system, you could quickly convince yourself that the dynamics are not changing because of that. So it really depends. I mean, I don't really know the answer to your question, I guess, is the main thing. But when you get close enough that all of this stuff starts to break down, it all kind of breaks down at the same time. Like any of the treatment that we have doesn't work for so many reasons. Certainly also the period is not constant over an orbit.
Every single graviton here has frequency omega.
In this particular system, yeah. Yeah. In this, but it would be a contrived system. But yes. Yes. Yes, thank you. Excellent point. It's actually 2 omega. So remember yesterday we had, when we worked out the formula, the trig works out to give you a 2 from the double angle formula. Thank you.
So this might be a related thing, but it interests me that the luminosity is intrinsically has to be related to it's the energy that's being shed, so it's related. It's the rate at which the change
yes.
is changing.
Yes, absolutely.
But this is assuming that there's no changing, and so I feel like if really nothing was changing, the luminosity should be zero, shouldn't it?
So you are losing energy. My claim is to keep this system. So with this formula, if you were to just take this and treat this as sort of separate parameters, and you had a machine where your goal was to keep these two masses moving at a fixed R with a fixed omega, you would have to put energy into that system.
Okay.
I mean, that's our expectation just because of, you know, friction and things. But even if you had a perfect machine, in the end of the day, you'd have to be putting energy into it because of gravitational wave emission.
Okay.
Now, the thing that this formula then considers is, imagine you take that and somehow, you know, it is in a vacuum and whatever, and you remove the rods, and so these things are now just going, and you happen to get it so that it exactly is a Keplerian orbit, right? You set up the initial conditions perfectly, you take out the rods, and now the thing is evolving. Of course, instantaneously, the answer doesn't change, but the point is the luminosity is a function of the period, and because it is taking energy away from the system and you're not putting it back in that case, it's a free system. What we'll find next is the period changes.
Because I can imagine a system where
so the luminosity then changes.
Your rate of change is either faster or slower than, I guess, usual? Is that like already included in this somehow?
I mean, at least to all the approximations that we've made,
okay.
And I mean, equal mass, but I mean, in addition to the silly Newtonian approximations, this is it.
Okay.
So, I mean, you can see how it scales, right? The bigger the mass, the higher the luminosity. The smaller the period, the higher the luminosity.
Okay.
And with, you know, the exponents as shown there. Good. Okay. This is my first time doing one of these lectures with my iPad, and it seemed like such a great idea. The jury is still out on that one. The notes app on the iPad is actually not super awesome. Okay. So if we go to look at the energy of this system, if it was a binary and Newtonian gravity, the total energy is, of course, kinetic plus potential, however you guys like to write the such things. Kinetic, there's two bodies at 1/2 mv squared, and the potential energy is negative, but it's m squared over 2. R, because the total separation is 2R. And well, another relationship we have, I guess, is the balance between centripetal and gravitational force. Give us one more relationship. So this implies m squared over 2R squared is mv squared over r. And if you trust the algebra, you take that information plus Kepler's law, and you can write that in terms of the period and mass. And what people did to get this sort of first approximation to what we now call binary in spiral, which is to really track the dynamics under gravitational radiation, is you imagine, you say, well, it's a Newtonian binary, but it's losing energy. So the energy is coming from this. So you have a time derivative of the energy. Period. Kepler's law. Specifically, like, I mean, we've written it down in a couple of different forms.
Like, what are we substituting into the EMH equation? I thought we were substituting the fourth FG but FC equation.
We're getting rid of R. Oh, sorry. We've got Newtonian, so we've got an expression for, you know, relating MVs and Rs in those two equations. This plus Kepler's law and some algebra gives you this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I thought we were substituting.
No, sorry, I just wanted to point out the sort of assumptions here. So we assume, you know, the standard Newtonian kinetic and potential energy for the total energy of the system, additional relationship about balancing the forces, and we put in Kepler's law and hopefully get all of our pi's and things right, and it's that. And so the idea is that this is a reasonable thing to do. Now, the real situation, of course, is way more complicated than this, but this turns out to really give you an excellent and even quite accurate picture of the dynamics at early stages, and frankly, an excellent qualitative picture of the dynamics right up to the bitter end.
That's a pretty silly question. Why is the potential energy negative?
Well, the potential energy is negative, and there's not enough kinetic energy to overcome it if it's a balanced system. Yeah. No, it's a good question. Signs of potential energy constantly. Okay. So, again, with some algebra slash light calculus, which I'm not going to prove, but you can check me if you want. I mean, check Hartle. If you instead write this as the time derivative of the period, you get something that looks like, I love the numbers that come out. Just makes me so happy. Clearly, right? So now you can see that the period is in fact changing as a function of time. So this system is not going to just stay at a constant period. And that's the key part here. Okay. I'll leave this, sorry. That's all we can do there. All right. So now we're kind of we'll come back to more about the physics of these binaries in a second, but I want to do a bit of a digression that I don't know how I don't know if the historical order here is right, but I'll pretend it is. So this is all fine and dandy, right? Like, you figure this stuff out. People figured this stuff out a long time ago. One of the early papers that did an even more extensive treatment than this, that took into account other Newtonian parameters like eccentricity and such, was Peter and Matthews, and maybe just also Peter in the early 60s. So you can go through there. They're good papers. Some of it's a little painful, but they're good papers. So this stuff was known really early. And so in some sense, we had a sense of what the dynamics would be for these systems long before we had ever observed anything that matched to these expectations. But in the early 70s, there was the first binary pulsar discovered, which I don't know if it, when it was originally named, if the B wasn't there, because I think B stands for binary, and maybe they hadn't figured that out yet. That might have been the IAU coming in after the fact and changing the name. B1913+16. This is what people probably know, or some of you at least know, as the Hulse-Taylor binary. And so this was a system where you had two neutron stars, one of them definitely a pulsar, in a relatively close orbit, a period of, I think, about 8 hours. And essentially, it's sort of a really great test for, you know, relativistic dynamics, certainly at the correct scale for this analysis to make sense. And if we write this dp dt in some more useful units astrophysically, we get -3.4 × 10^-12 m over m sun times 1 hour over p to the 5/3. And here you can see, if you were to put in a typical mass of the sun and a period of an hour, the time derivative of the period is still really, really tiny, right? The prefactor in here is 10^-12. So the Hulse-Taylor binary, two neutron stars, about 1.4 solar masses each. The period is 8 hours. So, you know, this isn't exactly unity, but, you know, it's
That's
in the ballpark.
If this period is 8 hours, they must be traveling awfully fast.
Not traveling nearly the speed of light. I mean, they're fast compared to, you know, the Earth's sun, but still very slow compared to the speed of light. So not relativistic in their motion. Not in that sense. Okay, so this dpdt, if you then actually plug in 1.4 solar masses and 8 hours, you would predict two times 10^-13 in round numbers. Now, the actual value is 2.4 × 10^-12. And don't be tempted to say, oh, that's the Newtonian approximation breaking down or whatever. It's actually, that's not where this is mostly coming from. This is actually due to the fact that the eccentricity of the orbit of this pulsar is very large. I mean, I don't know, maybe not very large, it's big. It's not zero, right? So, and that actually makes a correction. Have we done this, you know, like the Peter Matthews paper did more carefully with keeping factors of eccentricity and all that sort of stuff, we would have gotten a more accurate estimate of this. So I don't want to lead you astray that like we were just totally wrong. The problem is we didn't model enough even Newtonian physics to get this answer right. But the point is that it's a very small number.
Is it generally the eccentricity that gets you a corollary Matthews does?
Oh, I see. It kind of depends a little bit. There's a thing that we won't talk about at all, but one of the things that also turns out to be true in binaries is the eccentricity is radiated away. So as the binary evolves, it actually circularizes. So for LIGO, there's extremely good reason to believe the eccentricity will always be essentially zero. So it depends on when in the system you're talking about. But certainly in the case of LIGO sources for systems that have evolved freely for any reasonable amount of time, eccentricity is not an issue. So a natural question would be for some people in the audience, well, is this pulsar a LIGO source? And we're going to get there in a second.
So the eccentricity goes away faster than the...
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it does. And so, yeah, exactly. So it's basically always going to be the case where you have zero by the time it gets to LIGO. The one exception, I recently even tried to check this calculation for crazy primordial black hole things that could be formed at like maximal eccentricity, and it still goes to zero by the time it's in LIGO. The only way you can really get a residual eccentricity in LIGO, as far as I know, would be if you had some very late stage capture, which is essentially the binary is forming at a close separation, not from gravitational radiation, but from some other process. And then, you know, you can cook up just about anything you want. But that's considerably rarer than having the thing evolve due to gravitational radiation for a billion years or something. Okay. Yeah, okay, so one other bit. I apologize that the few bits of information I'm presenting right in a row here will seem a little disjoint, but I promise I will wrap them together in a second. So another thing which I'm not going to try to define at all, man, iPad needs to work on this. I'm gonna set it down. So another relevant bit of the dynamics which I won't derive or anything is the time to merger. So historically, we call this, instead of merger, coalescence. It's just a thing in our field. Merger has historically referred to a very special part of the, you know, nonlinear tie, like a nonlinear part in solving GR that people had talked about and called merger. But the point is like the time to basically when the system has formed a single black hole, we typically call coalescence. And this coalescence time is given by 5 over 256. And let's see, to put it in the same, the same parameters as our canonical binary, just to be consistent. And again, these things would all change, right, if I were including eccentricity or unequal masses, right? I want to keep going with this simple system and, okay. And I hope I didn't make any algebra mistakes on this. The numbers came out okay when I tried it out. So if you ask, if you take this sort of simple picture where the thing, you know, looks like Newtonian gravity except it's losing energy and you let it evolve, the time to where it coalesces, because eventually you'll get, you know, that the two objects are merged, is given by this. So you can see that it's a pretty steep function of radius. The further away you are, the longer it takes. You know, putting it even twice as far away, you know, means that it's going to take a lot longer for gravitational waves to cause it to merge. So you know that the thing has to be born pretty close together if it's going to merge in a reasonable amount of time. But it also inversely depends on mass. So if you have something really, really massive, it's going to merge more quickly.
Question.
Yes?
If you have two objects that are not black holes, so say neutron stars, I can imagine effects that would make this thing break down in weird and bizarre ways before you actually, do you actually get like one neutron star at the end of this?
You know, it's actually unknown. So in the sense that the two reasonable hypotheses are that one, you get a big neutron star at the end, or two, it collapses to a black hole. I believe that the majority of the astrophysicists and astronomers right this very second believe that in the case of the neutron star merger detected by LIGO, the final object was a black hole. What we don't know necessarily is if it lived as a hypermassive neutron star state first, or if the collapse was prompt or anything like that. There are people who have tried to estimate it with all sorts of different models. Maybe one of them is right. Maybe none of them is right. I don't know.
There's definitely like some sort of explosion phase.
So there's been an expectation for a long time that if two neutron stars smash together, it's going to be bright. It turns out it was. Though still brighter in gravitational waves, I'm pretty sure. The gravitational wave luminosity is enormous. You just can't see it as easily or hear it as easily. This is just rewritten then in terms of the orbital frequency omega. Okay, so now one other just reminder, you know, without any sort of prefactors or whatever, we had the strain, at least for one of the polarizations, was proportional to 2 omega. And then remember, we have this retarded time. So, you know, this is what the observer sees some distance r away. Yeah, sorry, what?
There's a couple of things. So you keep talking about things at the very end, like the coalescence, et cetera, and then yeah. R, the period. But by definition, when you're having that at the very, very end, that's exactly the point when those are changing really fast.
No, this is if you take a system at any given R or M that could be a big R, this is how long it'll take to merge. So if your question is this answer for a system that's born far apart going to change a lot by doing the higher order corrections? The answer is no.
I guess the question is, at what time do you evaluate R and omega?
So that's a great question, and we're getting there next.
Okay.
All right, so you're going to hear an experimental gravitational wave lecture later today. So probably you'll hear a little bit about how the detectors work. The only thunder I will steal is to give you that, roughly speaking, with present ground-based detectors, we cannot detect gravitational waves below 10 hertz. And you hear more explicitly why that is the case, so just take it. Take me on my word, 10 hertz is sort of a fundamental limit. So what that would mean is, and that's 10 hertz of gravitational wave frequency. So then what we want to consider is just that, you know, 2 omega is equal to 2 pi f, and plug in f of 10 hertz. So this implies that omega has to be 10 radians per second, 10 pi radians per second, before it's a LIGO source. Okay? So now, if we take that TC formula and basically evaluate the time starting when the configuration has a gravitational wave frequency of 10 hertz, okay? So with big omegas 10 pi per second. Then we plug all it in, and I'll spare you the details of the algebra. It comes out to about 1,000 seconds for a 1.4 solar mass binary. So 1.4 solar masses for each component. So what this is saying is, for a very relevant physical system, like for example, if you took the Hulse-Taylor binary, that LIGO is only really going to be sensitive for the last 1,000 seconds before merger. And even at this point, You do need to start modeling things a little more accurately than just the simple Newtonian model if you want to get parameters right. But for example, the higher order relativistic corrections to this number are still much less than 10%. So even if you calculate this TC correctly, it's going to be accurate to much, much better than 10%. So there's not a huge impact on the dynamics, even in the LIGO band. It's only really when the system is very, very close to merging that things go completely haywire. So this orbital frequency is clearly much, much higher than the orbital frequency of the Hulse-Taylor binary. With a period of 8 hours, it's clear that you're not going to really be a LIGO source for a long time. If you work out the Hulse-Taylor.
Is this good about cosmological redshift? Because I feel like if you're farther away, then you're going to have that frequency get redshifted out.
So what ends up happening, so the question is about redshift. And again, not going to get to it in this lecture, but essentially the mass gets adjusted by a factor of 1 plus c. And so, you know, everywhere, so mass is a characteristic scale for all the times here, right? Because mass has units of times. So that's how you see things coming into times. So the Hulse-Taylor binary, so PSR 1913 plus 16. Has, if we do this, so we get, just with this formula, which I've already said is not going to be right for this system, we get 2 billion years. The actual answer is 300 million years, I think. And again, this comes down to basically almost entirely effects of eccentricity. So just something where we've ignored in this toy model. Now, if you're all patient, or if you are part of the generation where your brains are going to be uploaded into a computer, congratulations. You will be around for this pulsar becoming a LIGO source in 300 million years. I am not going to hold my breath that I will be around to see that. So you know, this is not a LIGO source, nor will it be a LIGO source anytime soon. But what's important about this number, 300 million years, is that even though it's a big number, it's pretty small compared to the age of the universe. And the next bit of this story is to think about, in some sense, the probability that there might be something like it that is just 300 years more advanced than its evolution, which doesn't seem very far-fetched, again, because this is a pretty small number compared to the age of the universe. So the initial estimates of rates for LIGO, there are definitely sources before this, so I don't want to give all the credit to this particular author, but it's definitely one of the more famous papers. So Finney, in 1991, tried to use an estimate of the neutron star merger rate using not only the binary pulsar 1913 plus 16, but also I think there'd been two others discovered by then, at least one other, I think two. And the argument there basically goes, we know there are binary neutron stars that merge less than the age of the universe. We see more than one in our own galaxy, all right? So we can compute how often these things merge in our own galaxy. Given that that time scale is still pretty short compared to the age of the universe, it's reasonable to expect, you know, there are others that are merging now. And they may not be in our galaxy, but if all the other galaxies around us are similar enough, we'd eventually stumble upon a galaxy within some reasonable distance of Earth where the merger was happening right now. So that's the entire argument that Finney put forward.
Form the system more important than the length of time it takes for them to merge?
Well, it could be, but not necessarily. So from stellar evolution, the heavier the star, the shorter it's alive. Mm-hmm. So you can actually end up getting, you know, forming neutron stars relatively early from the perspective of stellar evolution. Because the stars that form neutron stars are 10 or 12 solar masses, probably. Black holes form even sooner. But, you know, it depends on how, I mean, so many, lots of things we don't know, in fact. I mean, there's the sort of separation at the birth of the binary. There is whether or not the binary survives at supernovas.
So if you're sensitive to about 1,000 seconds, right, for this system,
why are the LIGO chirps like ordered 10 seconds long?
That's an excellent question. They're actually even shorter than that. I mean, most of them are, right? The black holes are really short. So we'll see one here in a second that's like 150 milliseconds. An assumption I said out loud right on the board, but we'll drive home. You put a bigger M here and do the same thing. The time to merge is shorter. So you still started at 10 hertz, but the evolution from 10 hertz to coalescence is shorter as you increase the mass because of an equation that is apparently covered up now.
Is the luminosity goes up for mass,
that
means that to be bright enough to be seen, you want it to be more massive, yes? Is that part of this thing too?
Yeah, so everything else being equal, the higher the mass, the better off you are, because you're going to see, you know, it's going to be a stronger gravitational wave source. It turns out stellar evolution works against us a little bit. Not enough, apparently, but a little bit. And we thought for a long time it worked against us enough that high mass sources would be less likely. Turns out not to be true. Stellar evolution works against us because the initial mass function for stars favors small masses, which means you're not going to get many high mass black holes naively. So what that means is you have fewer high mass black holes in a given volume of space, which means odds are they are further away from you. But if they were the same distance, then they are way, way brighter. Okay, so Finney's argument, I'm not going to really provide much derivation of this. I just kind of want to give you a sense of how it went. It hinges on, you know, that we've observed these binaries. We can estimate their coalescence time. It's less than the age of the universe. We have them in our galaxy. The trick here is to come up with an estimate for the merger rate within our galaxy. And the way this was done, and I confess there's at least one part of his calculation that upon reading it again as recently as a few weeks ago, I wasn't exactly sure about, but turns out to have stood the test of time reasonably well, so he couldn't have been that wrong. The units are right. That's important. I think he might have called this a tau, actually. Sorry, and this is not equal sign. Just a product. Okay, so here, D, it's a D, which I'll explain what D means in a second. I think this is pretty much exactly the paper, one of the first equations that shows up in the paper, so I'll kind of try to get a sense of what it means. So D is, I think, the number of binary pulsars that have been observed. I mean, he wrote sort of a general expression. At the time, D was a fixed number. It was 3, I think, right? The general expression for this. V with a subscript I is the volume of, is the biggest volume of a pulsar survey that would have found it. I didn't exactly, I mean, I get what the effect he was trying to take into account. That's all I'll say about that. That's how it's worded in the paper. And then tau I is the merger time for that particular system. So there were basically 3 things that he was calculating this thing over. I mean, there was the pulse Taylor binary, and there are 2 other ones that I forget. It's the first one that's always the memorable. VI is the volume of a pulsar, the volume of the biggest pulsar survey that would have found it. Because, I mean, in principle, there were different people, different groups even. And in fact, his paper was written because some of the Caltech data was not yet published. Someone had done a similar derivation before using Harvard data. Anyway, I'm sure there's a very interesting history there that I don't know. But it depends on who's looking, because, I mean, you know, you want to fairly estimate. His goal is to estimate how many mergers per sort of unit volume in the galaxy happen. And to really get a sense of that, you need to know how far into the galaxy you've looked. And so this is trying to capture a reasonable estimate for what that should be. Like I said, I don't really understand the detail of the method, but I think it was an honest attempt to get that pinned down well. If you have a pulsar survey that only looks to the nearest pulsar and sees something, that's much more profound than a pulsar survey that sees the entire galaxy and only sees one thing. And so that's what this is trying to capture. Honestly, the main thing here is that he was able to come up with an estimate where, actually, let me show you one assumption, just so you know. He basically put, he modeled the galaxy as a thin cylinder that was 24 kiloparsecs radius and 2 kiloparsecs high. So that's how we got the volume of the Milky Way. And, you know, the really rough estimate without any, you know, without any sort of corrections for selection effects with the pulsars was 10 to the minus 6 per Milky Way. And if he included completely reasonable corrections based on the fact that a pulsar is beamed, meaning you have to kind of be, you know, oriented with respect to the radio waves that are being given off in order to see it. Essentially, what it means is that even if we've surveyed a few kiloparsecs around us and only seen one pulsar, there's probably two we haven't seen because they're probably just beamed away from us. So corrections of this sort led to sort of the canonical estimate from this paper of being 10 to the minus 5 per Milky Way galaxy per year. That's an important thing to make it a rate, sorry, per year. So again, if you, now you don't have to wait as long as 300 million years, but if you're really patient and you want to wait 100,000 years, you only need a gravitational wave detector that can survey our galaxy. So the next part of this argument goes,
Will this tau I?
Tau I is the merger time, sorry. This is just how he uses it in his paper. It's the same thing as our TC. It's actually not. It actually also takes into account the formation time, which is the less important effect, I'm pretty sure he concludes. I remember right. But let's pretend it's easy. Close enough. Okay. Right, so the next bit of this is an argument that tries to get beyond the galaxy. And this argument is that neutron star binaries are merge relatively quickly. And I mean, all things considered compared to the age of the universe, and they're born in star forming regions. So if we track how star-forming a galaxy is, that is a good indicator of the expected rate of neutron star mergers in that galaxy. So we can kind of normalize the merger rate of our galaxy to galaxies nearby by trying to track how many stars they're making in present day, all right? Or at least the present day that we observe from them. So to do that, he proposed blue light as the tracer. And the luminosity of the Milky Way in blue light, so blue in solar luminosities for Milky Way, that's got a lot of subscripts, is 2 times 10 to the 10. And the blue light luminosity density of the universe, so I could write that maybe as like the DL, it's constant, so it's not, it wouldn't have to be this ridiculous about how I write it, but in principle, it doesn't have to be constant. It could be a function of other things. Two times 10 to the 8 per megaparsec cubed. So if you ask what's the sort of, you just like forget about galaxies and treat the entire local universe as a continuum, which of course it's coming from galaxies, but you just sort of imagine that you're just smearing out over all the galaxies. The average blue luminosity density in these units of solar luminosities is 2 times 10 to the 8 per megaparsec cubes. That's how much blue light in these units the universe just has around us. So it's these, basically then the rate could be calculated as the rate of the Milky Way. Oops. Divided by the blue light luminosity of the Milky Way. I could also say that this, if it's completely isotropic or whatever, you could imagine that this is sorry about that. The point is I'm just imagining that I'm like, if I want to go out in a spherical volume, I could accumulate blue luminosity by taking 2 times 10 to the 8 times 4 pi r squared dr. So as far as out as I want to integrate that away from Earth, all I'm doing is literally taking a density and multiplying it by a volume. it's constant, so the need for some fancy integration is not important. In principle, this calculation can get harder. You could actually trace this over effects in terms of redshift and other things where you actually do need to be a little bit careful about what you're doing. But in the local universe, you just assume 2 times 10 to the 8. And so you can evaluate this essentially as as this, which you substitute in that. And so what this turns out to be is if you calculate the rate at less than or equal to 200 megaparsecs of a shell, a spherical shell, so a volume of Earth that corresponds, or a volume from Earth that corresponds to 4/3 pi times 200 megaparsecs cubed. Okay, so a sphere from Earth has a radius of 200 megaparsecs. Then you get a rate of 3 per year.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, I.
What are the rates in which are radii?
The little r is radii.
So you make the r less than or equal to. Okay.
As a subscript, thank you. Yeah. Just to denote that this is, if you did this integral from 0 to 200 megaparsecs in a spherical volume. Let me pause on that, because I think I could have. Been clear. All we're doing here is, in the simplest possible case, figuring out the total blue light in a sphere.
So
2 times 10 to the 8 times 4/3 pi r cubed, where r is in units of megaparsecs. Everyone good with that? It can be more complicated, and is more complicated for people who have done this in different ways, but the Finney argument was just this. Yeah, sorry. Do you have a question? Again, another question?
So, you said you were measuring the blue light in the universe, but this is the rate of black hole
neutron star merger, yes.
Yes.
So, but because what Finney said was that basically if you could work out the rate, and you could work out the rate in the Milky Way through this, and he came up with a number with some reasonable assumptions of 10 to the minus 5.
Okay.
The goal here is to take that number and turn it into a number that applies not just for our galaxy, but for the local universe. And so for that extrapolation to the local universe, he uses blue light as the way to calibrate the Milky Way merger rate to the merger rate of all the other galaxies nearby. And an even simpler assumption is he's not actually looking at galaxy catalogs and counting the light. He's just saying, screw it. It's 2 times, here's the density if galaxies were a continuum. So it's the simplest possible estimate of this.
These are the numbers that he would have used, or are they kind of numbers
yeah.
that we now know?
The numbers he would have used, and the numbers have not changed that much, actually, oddly enough. They changed by very little, yeah. Yeah.
Why the choice of 200 megaparsecs?
Well, that was definitely, I'm sure, some conversation that happened among the people that he was working with who were designing LIGO. I don't know. 200 megaparsecs turns out to be a very relevant number for LIGO, for advanced LIGO. But it also happens to be an even number where the rate goes above one, which is kind of really the motivation here, right? Okay. It's like, imagine you want to build an instrument that you can run for a year and detect something, right? So you could, in some sense, instead of picking the distance, you could have solved for the upper limit of the integration, you know, okay. Set this side to one, and then solve for
D. Okay, sure, I thought it astrophysically corresponded to something that was momentarily escaping me.
I don't think so. Okay. I don't think so. I could be wrong about that, but I suspect that some combination of solve for one and talk of advanced LIGO was how 200 megaparsec was chosen. You could ask Sterl. Okay, 3 per year. Now, I won't give you any additional details, but that number, of course, changed over the years as well. There was another binary pulsar found, even closer, together, yada, yada, yada. It went up by like a factor of 6 or something. So now we were sort of, you know, more than 10 per year within 200 megaparsecs. So this is kind of the situation going into the initial LIGO project. People had a really reasonable idea of the theory. Certainly in a simple case, people had already started working out all the higher order relativistic corrections as well, by the way, though that really didn't come until closer and closer to LIGO becoming a reality, in some sense, because who cares, unless you're going to measure it. It was all kind of coming together, but we also then had the binary pulsar observations, and we also had a realistic estimate of the rate. If you could build a detector that could see 200 megaparsecs, you're probably going to find something. So that's the story that sort of got LIGO built. I'll pause for any questions, because I think I'm moving on to something a little different. Okay.
People assume that black holes would be the same, so it's just an order one thing, or?
No. The intrinsic, well, so, I guess it's probably not fair to say. I mean, like, for all I know, people were probably doing black hole rates just as early as this, but, you know, you get biased as you go up in this sort of thing into what was actually said and what wasn't, I guess. The thing with black holes is a lot less was known, and there were no actual observations. So anything that you would do with black holes would have to come from a model for their formation rather than observational data. The key part of this argument in Finney is that they were observed pulsar binaries. The coalescence times were known. Like, it wasn't like, it was as observational as something like this could possibly be. There were no black hole binaries until LIGO. I mean, none. I mean, supermassive ones, but not at stellar mass. Like, we had no evidence of any type that black hole binaries existed. Of course, you expect that they could, but LIGO proved that in some sense. Now, everyone expected that they could, and people did, you know, the more sophisticated, more recent models were population synthesis models, which basically, you know, solved for stellar evolution and parameters and supercomputers and tried to predict distributions of neutron stars and black holes and stuff. And they came up with answers that, you know, with very uncertain rates, but with rates. Yeah.
Is there a particular reason for why they chose moonlight?
Yeah, star forming galaxies are blue.
Oh. Good call.
That might have been an oversimplification, but that's the sort of standard approach to that. And, you know, again, it's one of these deals where, because looking at the neutron star merger time is being so short, the logic was, you know, these things merge instantly after they formed, in some sense, right? And so if you look at the star forming, I don't know, this is how it went. Now, it's a natural question to ask if it's right, and it isn't, right? But but it got us, you know, it's as right as astrophysics often is in these cases. I say that out loud. Delete it. In actual fact, if you look at the neutron star merger, I'm not even sure how much this is publicized. I hope I'm not wrong about this. It was in a, I should know my galaxy morphology classifications better, but it was not a spiral galaxy. It was like kind of in the middle. Like it was one of these E-naught galaxies, which was like definitely not a spiral galaxy, which are historically blue star-forming galaxies, but not maybe as old as some of the elliptical galaxies. But it definitely wasn't a Milky Way-like galaxy. So we have one data point that says blue light might not have been the best choice. That could turn out to be, I mean, it could be a fluke. Maybe all the other ones that come from spiral galaxies. All right, good. So I need to get you guys into like some activities here. So let's hurry this up. All right, without any particular proof, I want to come back to binaries for a second and just write down my script M. Hopefully will look a little bit different from my regular M. This comes from a paper by Finn and Chernoff in 1993. So I'll explain what all these mean in a second. Well, look right now, in fact. M is different now. M is, rather than being this single mass, so this generalizes now to unequal mass. I'm not going to prove how this comes out, but it generalizes to unequal mass. And it adds in, this is now the plus polarization that a given detector would, well, actually not quite. It's the plus polarization taking into account the observing angle and some other things. So the iota here is the inclination of the orbit with respect to the observer. That's not really relevant for anything else we're going to talk about. I'm not even going to go into any of that stuff, but just so you see it, there is an angle dependence that hasn't really been explicitly mentioned until right now. M, the script M, is called chirp mass, and this will play an important role in the rest of our conversation. And it's a funny combination of masses that just is what it is, so. So deal with it. And actually, if you want to see, there is a redshift factor that comes in there. So the mass at the source is different than what the observer would detect some redshift. That's all I'll have to say about that. Redshift is small, it's the same number. Most of our redshifts have been small. The numbers change by at most 10%. That won't be true going forward. F is equal to 1 over pi chirp mass 5 over 256 chirp mass over capital T minus T to the 3/8. You can ask me about phase. You can actually get phase from frequency and other things. I'm not going to have time to really go through with that. It's not important for the rest. I do want to point out F. So here, this is the time before merger, this quantity capital T minus T. So it puts coalescence at T, and you're looking for the time before merger. Sorry?
Time before merger.
From whatever time you want to pick. Like, you pick the time. As long as you pick the merger time, this tells you the gravitational wave frequency instantaneously at that time. So it is a function of chirp mass. Frequency is a function of time before coalescence. So this is like the waveform that in some sense was, you know, this would have been enough, I think. I haven't tried myself, but should have been probably enough to find the neutron star merger, for example. The waveforms we actually use in LIGO were more sophisticated than this. That in and of itself is like two courses to probably get to really do a thorough job on that. And so there's, I mean, two courses, like two semesters, let alone two summer school lectures. But I mean, the qualitative stuff is more or less captured here. What you find is that, you know, the frequency, amplitude, other things depend on more physical parameters. But the sort of leading order effect is captured by this.
Thing in front of F in that formula is the chirp mass again? Does it
indicate
pi or?
1 over pi m.
Pi.
Where m is the chirp mass.
And then in the formula up there, it's pi mf to the 2/3? Every top of that door?
Yeah. Yes, sorry, yes, f, thank you. Yes, sorry. So then this is the expression for f. I'm not sure why Sam wanted to write it out this way, but I like it. Three lines, but the first formula is pretty simple.
Can you give us details on the two
phi
psi?
So psi is like a free phase and the polarization angle, which is basically a free parameter. So I mean, it is what it is. Phi, I can go ahead and write down phi.
I'm just wondering what they're.
Also d, by the way, this is the luminosity distance to the source. Phi is pretty easy, so I'll just write down. Phi is minus 2 t minus t over 5 times chirp mass to the 5/8.
What should I think of this as?
It's the phase. I mean, so it's the argument to, like, in our cosine 2 omega t, like this phi is replacing the 2 omega t, remembering that omega itself is changing as a function of time because of gravitational radiation, right? That's the key. Omega is changing. And so this phi is captured, is the replacement for omega in our contrived system where it's actually evolving according to gravitational radiation.
Sorry.
Yes.
Phi is just a replacement for, like, if you had 2 omega t plus phi?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so there's an F here, so the amplitude is also increasing as you go forward in time. The phase is increasing, and a signal that has both the amplitude and frequency is increasing, an amplitude and frequency increasing signal is generally called a chirp, and it sweeps upward in both amplitude and frequency. The specific form of this chirp, of course, is this functional form. Anything that has that behavior is called a chirp.
Why do you call F the frequency? Because I thought that the frequency was the thing that would be inside the cosine,
The F and phi are related to a time derivative. That if you took the time derivative, you'd get. I don't know why Sam wrote it this way. This is how it is. In the end, I was mostly, honestly, I wanted to introduce this because this is the equation that I'm going to care about going forward. All right. The gravitational wave frequency is a function of time.
Large T and small t.
Large T is coalescence time, which is just when the binary is going to merge, and T is the time parameter before coalescence.
What is I?
I, iota, is the inclination angle of the orbital plane. Yeah. So there is an angular dependence to the amplitude.
When you say time before coalescence, does that mean the length of time it took it to get there, or is that the current? Which of these is the variable that we're moving at the evolving time?
Little t. Capital T is the constant. Little t is the variable. It's the standard time variable. Okay. Yeah. Sorry.
You mentioned that if I is zero, that means we're looking at a face on? Or
yes. Face on.
So the idea is that the things are polarized in the direction of the perpendicular.
The plus polarization is stronger. In that case, there's a cross polarization that I haven't written. Edge on, you only get one polarization.
Oh, edge on is the polarization.
Yeah. Okay. I want to really briefly. Okay, so this, again, we're not going to have any opportunity to talk about anything fancy. I've put all of my erasers up there.
Yeah, they're all up on the top edge.
All right. So I'll leave our canonical binary picture up there. Again, we're allowing M1 and M2 to be different now when we talk about that gravitational waveform that LIGO could observe. And let's talk about realistic objects for a second. In actual fact, the corrections to the dynamics due to, you know, actual general relativity matter in a more profound way than what I'm going to just tell you about. What I'm trying to give you is a sense of the absolute, clearly things have gone wrong kind of thing. So this, like formally speaking, goes all the way to infinity, right? It predicts an infinite frequency. And you can define coalescence as an infinite frequency in some sense, right? Like they're point particles, they just keep orbiting faster and faster and faster and faster and faster until they reach infinity. Clearly something doesn't sound right about that. So let's just use sort of silly geometrical arguments to think about when things could be wrong. We take a realistic binary system. We've kept it at radius about some common center, capital R. Forgive me, I'm going to use lowercase r here, not to be the observer distance, but the radius of the component object. All right, sorry. Running out of R's, I could, I don't know.
I suggest just
rho. Rho comes in later, so, you know, don't know what you want me to say. Only so many letters, even when you include Greek ones. So, right, so when R, so I mean, basically when you can think of this sort of naively, when lowercase r is much, much less than r, the point particle approximation should be pretty reasonable. It's always the sort of standard point particle approximation to things, right? When the size of the object is small compared to other distances in the problem, it's a point particle. Same thing's true here. So for a neutron star, little r is 10 kilometers, let's say. And you already then can see that when the thing is within, you know, when capital R is getting close to 10 kilometers, there's an issue. So neutron stars are finite-sized objects. When they touch, surprise, gravitational wave radiation is not going to be the dominant thing determining the dynamics. When two giant atomic nucleuses touch, moving at nearly the speed of light, other things are happening. So clearly, you know, we don't have to really worry about the, I mean, there's, even if the dynamics were this simple Newtonian thing up until the bitter end, something happens that keeps us from getting to an infinite frequency. Even for black holes, and this is a bit of a stretch, but for black holes, if you imagine the event horizon R equals 2m for a Schwarzschild black hole being some special surface, the black holes are sort of effectively touching at some finite distance, right? And so again, like just even from thinking of finite size effects of these objects, it's pretty clear that, you know, the dynamics break down for that reason alone. Of course, the actual dynamics are changing up until that point as well. There's one other thing just to give you a qualitative sense about this that I want to mention, which is an extreme example. So here we'll allow the mass of one object to be much larger than the other object. So in that case, we can really think of like a perturbation, like a test particle in some sense in a more fixed background space-time. So for example, a Schwarzschild black hole. So in this case, we've got a black hole with R2m for a Schwarzschild radius, and you've got some other particle, we'll call this big R, it's not quite the big R that we had before, but some other particle that's some distance away. In this scenario of a test particle, there's something very special that happens in both the Schwarzschild and Kerr geometry, which is you cease to have stable circular orbits beyond some finite radius. This is called the innermost stable circular orbit. Anyone know what it is for the Schwarzschild black hole? No, that's the light, the photon orbit. Close. There's a different one for mass. 6. So it's a very special system. It's a test particle, so one black hole will be very much smaller than another. But again, the GR in the simplest prediction, you know, from the stationary space-time, even then predicts that at some point you can't just keep getting closer and closer and closer. The black hole just absorbs a massive particle. There are no stable circular orbits. So unless it has some energy to get away, it's going in. All right, so this gives you some sense. Now, the reality is somewhere, you know, in between. The two things are comparable in mass. The test particle values don't quite work out, but there's a similar sort of thing going on. I mean, you know, all things considered, there will be some finite radius where the two objects will just plunge. And it's a similar kind of conceptual phenomenon as this. Okay. So, I want to get to our exercise before lunch. The next topic, which we'll pick up again with tomorrow, but we're going to introduce today, and we're going to do an in-class exercise. It's going to be super fun. You're going to love it. I don't know what board I want to erase. We call this one Chirp Mass by I. Thank you. I forgot about the counterweight. So many things to remember. I don't know, what's responsible for the board going up? Is it like dark energy or something? I don't know. You guys just were at summer school about this. You should tell me. This makes no sense. All right. Chirp mass by I. We're going to start with this formula. Oh, well, actually, it's over there. I'm not going to rewrite it. This 1 over pi m f blah, blah, blah to the 3/8. That's going to be our key formula. I am going to rewrite this without algebra. If you want proof, try to work through it yourself or ask me later. This can be rewritten as chirp mass. It should be simple algebra, hopefully. 256 over 5 t, big T. Minus T. To the negative 3/5 pi F to the negative 8/5. And I'm gonna do one other thing, which is I'm gonna relate the period to the frequency. So frequency is 1 over the period P. And I'm gonna write it like this, and I'll explain what this means in a second.
So basically, oh, I
Now, I've given the subscript I, because what we're going to do please pass these along. We're going to look at an actual gravitational waveform, and we're going to take each period and treat it as a separate measurement of this quantity. All right? So I is denoting, like, every period of the gravitational waveform as a separate measurement. From that, and this drawing with the legend that I've given you for indicating how big the line spacing is in milliseconds, we can calculate the ti, which is the time from the merger all the way back cumulatively to the period you're looking at, and the frequency. Actually, I'll rewrite this in terms of an even simpler expression, sorry. So this can simplify even more. Just, I'll do the math for you, because there's no point in... There was a subscript here, here, and here.
So why is big T not a subscript?
Sorry. Just take the, we'll take the coalescence time to be zero. What we're really doing is just counting backwards from the coalescence time, right? So that, so here's how this works. So if you take each one of these I's as a separate measurement, what you're gonna do, you have a waveform. It goes upward in frequency and amplitude. I worked with the bottom peaks, just because that's what I chose first. You could try it with the top. So essentially, defining coalescence as the biggest oscillation at the end, because eventually it dies back down again, as you'll see in the signal. Define that as your coalescence. Work backwards, that's the first period, that's the second period, et cetera. You're keeping track of two numbers. You're keeping track of Ti, which is the cumulative time from this to the period you're talking about. And then you're also keeping track of this, which is the period between the cycles. Does that make sense? So with this, you can essentially treat each period as a separate measurement of the chert mass. You'll get, you know, 4 or 5 different estimates and take the average and we'll see how well you do. This is how we do LIGO parameter estimation. We pay teams of graduate students. You get out their rulers. No, you're not getting paid. The chert mass is a process, so it actually does a little bit, but that's a whole other story. But for, let's ignore that. it changes by 10%. But actually, not during this. During what you'll see, it changes by much less.
Then it's getting down to really.
Each line, each small grid is 3 milliseconds.
That's probably here. 0, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, insane. So 3 milliseconds per
little tick. Yeah.
About 9 milliseconds.
Yeah.
This is big.
I don't know what
time it is. Right?
You're being way more precise than I am, then.
It's
counted 3, as I said.
This should be roughly 6.
Okay.
I wish I had a cookie for the team who comes the closest. Oh, by the way, you're not allowed to look it up and cheat.
What you do is you offer them a free suite at the coffee break.
Yeah, that's right. You can have any cookie you want at the coffee break.
Oh, it's all.
Huh?
Technically, from low point to low point, shouldn't that be 1/2 of the cookie? You're going up again.
Yeah. It's P. And I used the bottom. I didn't try it for the top. It should come out similar. But. Yes, exactly. Yeah, the first TI and PI will be the same. The first coming from the backwards. But yeah, you're working from merger backwards.
Milliseconds.
Yeah, I think so. Yes, let me look. No, the units are not milliseconds. I'll give you the conversion factor. Come up with it. Come on, people. So hold on a second. Who remembers the mass of the sun in seconds? Come on. Yeah. So you can figure it out.
So TI is just commute.
Yeah, so it's the units are in seconds, not milliseconds.
So the TI is just...
Wait, we have...
We just sum them up.
The units are in seconds, but you're, so you get an answer. Your answer will be in seconds. So you got to convert seconds to solar masses.
So wait, wait, so the formula...
This formula is in units of seconds. Mass will have units of seconds in your answer. That's fine. You get an answer that is seconds. I'm happy if you get the answer in seconds. We'll convert it to solar masses after you have.
My question is, does the 0.015 already do seconds?
No. This is in units of seconds. The formula, as written on the board, is units of seconds.
But what are we plugging in? Seconds or milliseconds?
It's in units of seconds, so you should plug in seconds.
So when it says each tick mark is 3 milliseconds, are those the big?
No, they're the small tick marks. Yeah, sorry. The smallest grid, milliseconds, so 3 milliseconds, otherwise known as 3 × 10⁻³ seconds.
3 milliseconds is the small one.
Oh my God.
All the stuff we've just talked about, and this is the hardest part. Okay. Everything was fine up until now.
I think the word tick mark is right.
Tick mark.
The smallest grid on your paper. 3 × 10⁻³ seconds.
You want to divide that. Because your graph has got a bunch of tick marks.
Those are the major tick marks. There's minor and major tick marks.
You just say
I'm sorry, it is my fault, but please accept that this is, in fact, what you should be using.
You can say 60 solar masses.
Is that the equation?
You use this equation.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the mean.
Calculate. Look. All right. Here we go.
No.
This equation. This equation is in seconds.
Yes.
SI people. Seconds.
It's okay.
This is your grid in seconds. You will get an answer in seconds, in geometrized units. You were all cool with G equals C equals 1 on day 1. You're like, G equals C equals 1, right?
I'm still cool with G equals C equals 1.
Good. So in that unit, in the system of units where G is equal to C is equal to 1, mass has units of seconds. You were the ones that wanted this. I could have kept all the G's and C's. You're all like, we're theorists. We're good with G equals C equals 1. Apparently not. I can tell. I can tell. This is why you must remember the mass of the sun in seconds. It will save you.
Unless that mass is supposed to also be in seconds.
The mass is in seconds. That's the point.
Okay, what was the mass of the sun in seconds?
50 microseconds.
5 × 10⁻¹⁵. Actually, it's... It's
50 micro, right?
50
micro.
Yeah.
5 × 10⁻⁵.
It's 5 × 10⁻⁶, right?
Yeah.
So 5 microseconds.
5 microseconds.
Yeah. 5 microseconds. Oh. Sorry.
Yeah.
You had me questioning if I knew the mass of the sun. See the effect you've had on me now.
Ten.
If there was one thing I knew, it was the mass of the sun in seconds.
Oh, that's not what I have.
How much? How much? Okay.
We have 30 solar masses.
Okay. Did you average the different measurements?
Average across them.
It's 29 average.
29 average.
Can we do the screen? I'm going to plug this thing in. Nice. So it's reasonable to assume that the last period before merger, things are probably not going to have worked out. So if your estimate of the shirt mass in that last period is a little wonky, that's reasonable. I'm happy even if you throw out that last bin, right? I took 4.
Okay.
I took four, I excluded the last one and did the four previous.
So, right, so that one brings us down a bit, but the others.
So then we have 30.
Yeah, I think, yeah, around 30.
30 is fine.
Perfect. I think we're right. Yeah, we're definitely correct.
See at least 20 data points.
Come on, be reasonable.
Everything's worth listening to the lab for my astronomy 101 students.
There you go. So I cheated and like used, you know, Photoshop effectively. I got it really accurate. But honestly, I think you'd have gotten it pretty close too. So I did the bottom and I stopped here because I could have imagined going further, but it started to look kind of messy. I figured if it didn't make sense after this many, then the whole idea was stupid. So these are the values I got: 6.9, 11.5, 17.2, 18.8, 21.5 for the periods, and then the cumulative time going backwards. I got those values in milliseconds, which I converted to seconds. You know, in the standard way. And then...
How do you do that?
Milliseconds to seconds? I don't know. Okay. So when I plugged all this in, I got a chirp mass for this bin of... This first one gave me something small, 21. This was 26, 33, 30, and 30. I averaged these four. I mean, given everything I've told you, it'd be pretty unreasonable to expect this to work right before a merger. There are so many reasons, including the one we just went through, well, that's probably a bad idea. But averaging these four bins, I get 30 solar masses. The actual value in the detector frame was 30.4 solar masses, measured in the correct way, which we'll learn about next time. So this is not how we do LIGO data analysis. I'm a LIGO data analyst. Trust me, it's a little harder than this. This particular signal was nature being very kind to us for so many reasons, but it is nice to point out that even the sort of silly textbook level kind of look at this makes sense even for this precision measurement. So it's lunchtime. I will see you tomorrow.